In 1801, the preliminaries of peace with England and Austria were signed. Peace with England, the Treaty of Amiens, was concluded in 1802, and Napoleon was free to give himself to the creative statecraft, of which France and Europe, through France, stood in need. The war had given the country extended boundaries. The treaty with England restored the colonial empire of France and left her in a position of security beyond the utmost dreams of Louis XIV. It was open to Napoleon to work out and consolidate the new order of things, to make a modern state that should become a beacon and inspiration to Europe and all the world. He attempted nothing of the sort. He didn't realize that there were such things as modern states in the scheme of possibility. His little imitative imagination was full of a deep, cunning dream of being Caesar all over again, as if this universe would ever tolerate anything of that sort ever again. He was scheming to make himself a real emperor, with a crown upon his head, with all his rivals and schoolfellows and friends at his feet. This could give him no fresh power that he didn't already exercise, but it would be more splendid. It would astonish his mother. What response was there in a head of that sort for the splendid creative challenge of the time? At first, France must be prosperous. France, hungry, would certainly not endure an emperor. He set himself to carry out an old scheme of roads that Louis XV had approved. He developed canals, in imitation of the English canals. He reorganized the police and made the country safe. And, preparing the scene for his personal drama, he set himself to make Paris look like Rome, with classical arches, with classical columns. Admirable schemes for banking development were available, and he made use of them. In all these things he moved with the times. They would have happened with less autocracy, with less centralization, if he had never been born. And he set himself to weaken the Republicans, whose fundamental convictions he was planning to outrage. He recalled the émigrés, provided they gave satisfactory assurances to respect the new regime. Many were very willing to come back on such terms, and let Bourbons be bygone. And he worked out a great reconciliation, a concordat, with Rome. Rome was to support him, and he was to restore the authority of Rome in the parishes. France would never be obedient and manageable, he thought. She would never stand a new monarchy without religion. How can you have order in a state, he said, without religion? Society can't exist without inequality of fortunes, which can't endure apart from religion. When one man is dying of hunger near another who is ill of surfeit, he can't resign himself to this difference unless there's an authority which declares God wills it thus. There must be poor and rich in the world, but hereafter and during all eternity the division of things will take place differently. Religion, especially of the later Roman brand, was, he thought, excellent stuff for keeping the common people quiet. In his early Jacobin days he had denounced it for that very reason. Another great achievement which marks his imaginative scope and his estimate of human nature was the institution of the Legion of Honour, a scheme for decorating Frenchmen with bits of ribbon which was admirably calculated to divert ambitious men from subversive proceedings. And also Napoleon interested himself in Christian propaganda. Here's the Napoleonic view of the political uses of Christ, a view that has tainted all French missions from that time forth. It's my wish to establish the institution for foreign missions, for the religious missionaries may be very useful to me in Asia, Africa, and America, as I shall make them reconnoiter all the lands they visit. The sanctity of their dress will not only protect them, but serve to conceal their political and commercial investigations. The head of the missionary establishment shall reside no longer at Rome, but in Paris. These are the ideas of a roguish merchant rather than a statesman. His treatment of education shows the same narrow vision, the same blindness to the realities of the dawn about him. Elementary education he neglected almost completely. He left it to the conscience of the local authorities, and he provided that the teachers should be paid out of the fees of the scholars. It's clear he didn't want the common people to be educated. He had no glimmering of any understanding why they should be. But he interested himself in the provision of technical and higher schools because his state needed the services of clever, self-seeking, well-informed men. This was an astounding retrogression from the great scheme drafted by Condorcet for the Republic in 1792 for a complete system of free education for the entire nation. Slowly but steadfastly, the project of Condorcet comes true. The great nations of the world are being compelled to bring it nearer and nearer to realization, and the cheap devices of Napoleon pass out of our interest. As for the education of the mothers and wives of our race, this was the quality of Napoleon's wisdom. I do not think that we need trouble ourselves with any plan of instruction for young females. They can't be better brought up than by their mothers. Public education isn't suitable for them, because they're never called upon to act in public. Manners are all in all to them, and marriage is all they look to. The First Consul was no kinder to women in the Code Napoleon. A wife, for example, had no control over her own property. She was in her husband's hands. This code was the work very largely of the Council of State. Napoleon seems rather to have hindered than helped its deliberations. He would invade the session without notice and favor its members with lengthy and egotistical monologues, frequently quite irrelevant to the matter in hand. The council listened with profound respect. It was all the council could do. He would keep his counselors up to unearthly hours and betray a simple pride in his superior wakefulness. He recalled these discussions with peculiar satisfaction in his later years, and remarked on one occasion that his glory consisted not in having won 40 battles, but in having created the Code Napoleon. So far as it substituted plain statements for inaccessible legal mysteries, his code was a good thing. It gathered together, revised, and made clear a vast disorderly accumulation of laws, old and new. Like all his constructive work, it made for immediate efficiency. It defined things and relations so that men could get to work upon them without further discussion. It was of less immediate practical importance that it frequently defined them wrongly. There was no intellectual power, as distinguished from intellectual energy, behind this codification. It took everything that existed for granted. Sa Majesté ne croit que ce qui est. The fundamental ideas of the civilized community and of the terms of human cooperation were in process of reconstruction all about Napoleon, and he never perceived it. He accepted a phase of change and tried to fix it forever. To this day, France is cramped by this early 19th century strait waistcoat into which he clapped her. He fixed the status of women, the status of laborers, the status of the peasant. They all struggle to this day in the net of his hard definitions. So briskly and forcibly Napoleon set his mind, hard, clear, and narrow, to brace up France. That bracing up was only a part of the large egotistical schemes that dominated him. His imagination was set upon a new Caesarism. In 1802, he got himself made First Consul for life, with the power of appointing a successor, and his clear intention of annexing Holland and Italy, in spite of his treaty obligations to keep them separate, made the peace of Amiens totter crazily from the very beginning. Since his schemes were bound to provoke a war with England, he should at any cost have kept quiet until he had brought his navy to a superiority over the British navy.